Today I'm interviewing Simon Ager. He lives in Bangor in Wales, but is from Lancashire in England. Simon runs one of the most popular language-related websites in the world, Omniglot. He started in 1989 and now counts almost 2 million visitors per month. He speaks English, French, Welsh, Mandarin, and Irish fluently, can get by with 6 more languages, and has learned many more languages besides that. Simon, I'm so glad that you can be here today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Omniglot is an extremely extensive and amazing resource for language learners, for people interested in languages and so on. I had a look at it, but there's so much stuff. I don't feel like I can give a good representation of what it is, what a person can do there. Maybe you can explain the extensiveness and what people can find there when they go to Omniglot.
Okay. Well, it started originally as a guide to different kinds of alphabets and writing systems. So I studied Chinese and Japanese in university, and that got me interested in different kinds of scripts and writing systems. And then I discovered there's all these other ones out there, and I wanted to learn about them, and I decided to share it with the world. And it kind of grew from there. So you got guides, profiles of every written free writing system on alphabet and syllabary in the world, pretty much. There may be a few I've missed, and people are always saying, oh, you should have included this one or that one. Usually ancient ones that are not used anymore or ones that have been invented recently. There are also 500 or so invented scripts that people send me. I get those regularly, several every month. And there are profiles of many, many languages. I haven't counted recently, but last time I counted, there was over 900 different languages on there. Wow. Basic information about where the language is spoken, how it's pronounced. I try and get sample texts, recordings, phrases, numbers, and other basic information. So you can use the site to learn the basics of many, many different languages, to learn about languages. There's advice on how to learn languages. There are many articles about languages, about learning them, about using them, about culture, travel, and such like. So you can use it in many different ways. Mm-hmm.
And now you've looked at many scripts. How many scripts can you read or write yourself?
Well, I can recognize all of the natural scripts on Omniglot. Mm-hmm. But actually reading and writing is another thing. What can I read and write? Well, the Latin alphabet, obviously, Cyrillic. I can read Greek, but can't write it very well. Same with Arabic and Hebrew. I can sort of get by in Georgian. I can make some sense of it. Chinese and Japanese, Korean, and maybe one or two others. But, I can't read any of us fluently.
Okay. But you've learned them. And did you, I guess, every time you learned a new one, you started to be better at recognizing patterns or reading them better? Like, what do you think is the best way to learn a new alphabet?
Well, initially, just learn how to write each letter, each symbol. There is usually a standard way of writing it, especially with Chinese characters. You have to know which stroke to write and which direction to write them in. And with most other ones, there is probably a standard way of doing that. So learn how to write it by hand. Learn how to type it. You have to remap your fingers. If you're used to touch typing in your own language, and then learning to touch type in another language takes time. There are online programs you can use to help you with that. That's something I'm trying to do in Russian at the moment. Because when I write, if I write in Russian on my phone or on my tablet, it's got a virtual keyboard. Mm. So you can just see all the letters. If I write on my normal computer, it doesn't have the letters on the keys. So I have to learn where they are.
Yeah.
So that's quite important if you're going to do a lot of typing in another language. And then just writing everything as many times as you can. Like when I was learning Chinese and Japanese, I wrote every character out, I don't know, hundreds of times. I had little character cards know, there's a character on one side and the meaning and some example words on the other side. You can do that virtually now with things like Anki and other spaced repetition systems. To actually learn to read the language fluently, now that's a different thing altogether. Because you can learn the individual letters. So with Russian, say, I can look at a word and I can, you know, I know how to pronounce it,
mm-hmm.
if I know where the stress is. But actually reading a Russian text fluently is a different matter, because I for words I'm not familiar with, I have to look at each individual letter and then work out what the word is.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm reading English or French, or other languages I know well, I don't need to do that. I look at each word.
Yeah.
So in order to become fluent in actually reading a language, you have to do a lot of reading.
Okay.
And also maybe listening to audiobooks while you're reading can help mm-hmm. you with pronunciation.
So, but you said you would start writing the language, or you would start trying to recognize the different letters?
Well, you need to recognize them and be able to produce them as well. So there's two different things there,
mm-hmm.
but they're connected.
Okay.
If you can write them, you can always also recognize them.
Mm-hmm.
So
yep.
practicing to write them will help you recognize them, and reading them will help you to write them as well, probably.
Okay. So many different things, like writing
yeah.
it, reading them, typing them, and listening to audiobooks while reading whatever
yeah.
you.
Okay. Yeah. And also reading aloud is a good exercise.
Okay. And so you're a historian. You studied origin of languages, and you know a lot about languages, about the languages themselves, how they developed. And
well, it's not something I've studied kind of formally, but something I'm very interested in.
Yeah, and that's obvious with Omniglot, with all that information. And so I was wondering, I know there, I'm interested in the history of languages, like where they come from, but are there any interesting facts that many people don't know about languages, about a particular language, about how they developed? Like, what are things that blow your mind about the history of languages?
Well, it's a big subject. I mean, if you're looking at history of languages going back to the first humans, then you know, it's all speculation. We don't know how languages developed.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of interesting theories. But if you're looking at how languages developed more recently, that's also very interesting. For some languages, we know, kind of for Latin, how it developed into all the different descendants, like mm-hmm. French and Spanish and Italian. For other languages, we're not so sure, because the proto-languages, the original languages, aren't spoken anymore. Like for the Germanic languages,
mm-hmm.
you know, we have the modern ones, but we only have traces of the older ones. So they have to be reconstructed.
Mm-hmm.
And then and when you go back, then you find connections between different languages, and that's something I'm very interested in. So if I learn a word in one language, and I think, now how's that connected to any other languages I know?
Mm-hmm.
And if you go back and look at the roots, you can often find a connection. It might not mean the same thing in each language.
Yeah.
For example, in Welsh, the word for sing is canu, and a song is can. And that goes right back to the Proto-Indo-European. In mm-hmm. Proto-Indo-European, the word for song is can.
Okay.
So it hasn't changed over 4,000 or 5,000 years, which is incredible. But in other languages, the word for song and singing is different, but you can find connections. In English, the word with the same root is chant.
Mm-hmm.
And then in other languages, you can find similar words that have not exactly the same meaning, but kind of similar meanings. So I find that fascinating.
Yeah.
And it helps me remember words as well if I know their history.
And what I always wonder is, how is it possible that a language simplifies or makes grammar really complex, like closely related languages, like for instance German and English? Like German has four cases, English does not. Like, do you know how that's possible, that some seemingly close languages have, one has a very simple grammar and one does not?
Well, yeah, you can say, you know, German grammar is complex compared to English, But English has other complexities that German doesn't have.
That's true.
And so languages, they change over time. They may not become simpler in some ways. They lose some aspects of their grammar and gain other aspects. So, for example, in Proto-Indo-European, they probably had eight noun cases, and only a few languages in the Indo-European family still retain that many cases. I think Lithuanian, Latvian, Polish, and maybe one, and Sanskrit, but most have lost some or all of their cases. And the way languages change over time is fascinating because they words can lose endings or gain endings, can fuse together in various ways. So if you have, for example, where a word is stressed, that tends to be more stable. Unstressed syllables can disappear. So, for example, in Czech, quite a lot of the vowels that used to be in the older Slavic language that it descended from, they disappeared. So you get consonant clusters. But in other Slavic languages, they're still there. But because those vowels were unstressed syllables, they became reduced over time until they just disappeared altogether. So that's one thing that can happen. And then words in languages are not written down. People can kind of think about how the words connect together in different ways. And when they get written down, then, well, the kind of how the words are divided up can change. Because when you're speaking, you're not speaking in one word at a time. You're speaking a whole flow of words. So if your language has never been written down, where the words are divided up can change over time more easily. So that's how some ways in which language can change over time is and also consonants can change if they're between vowels. Like in Spanish, the D, when it's between two vowels, like in nada, is a the sound rather than a d. And that's very common. The letters that come around other letters, they kind of letters influence each other, basically. So they kind of, in English, for example, a negative suffix like in, invisible, in some words becomes im, like impossible. Because the P influences the N and becomes an M sound because it's easier to pronounce. So that's very common as well.
All right, and
So there's lots of different ways in languages can change. And also, for example, with English, in Old English it used to be much more like German with all the cases and the more complex inflectional system. But then it got into contact with other languages, with Celtic languages, with Old Norse, which was slightly different, but still a Germanic language, with Northern French, and then all those kind of languages kind of combined elements together and influenced each other, and then we got modern English.
And do you feel like all this knowledge about language and grammar and influence helps you learn a new language or learn a language in general?
To some extent, I think knowing kind of how languages can change and the processes they go through, and kind of you become more aware of how patterns form and vocabulary and sound changes. So if you're learning a closely related language, if you know kind of how sounds are different in one language compared to another, then it can help you with vocabulary. You can kind of guess some words. If you don't know them, you know them in one language, and you can think, oh, yeah, it's probably like this in another language.
And you have lived in a few areas of England with different English accents, and I read that you're quite good at imitating different accents.
Yeah, not bad, yeah.
And like, how does that come about, and how do you think somebody like? how do you think somebody could learn to speak with a good accent in the language they're learning?
I think you need to do a lot of listening, and listening, find someone you want to imitate, find an accent you like with a sound up, and then listen to people who speak like that, try and imitate them, and listen carefully to how to the sounds they make, pay particular attention to the vowels, because they carry a lot of the accent, and also to the intonation patterns and the stress patterns of their speech. So, for example, when people are learning English, they often, well, no, it's not just English, any language, they'll carry over intonation patterns from their own language into the new language. But if you want to sound more like a native speaker, you need to pay attention not just to the individual sounds, but how all the words fit together and how they go up and down in their speech and where they put the stress. Now, those are almost more important than the individual sounds. Okay. That's the, in linguistic terms, that's the prosody of speech, the melody and the intonation patterns. So it's not just in languages like Chinese, you get that. Every language has its own intonation patterns. But they change. In Chinese, they're fixed, pretty much.
Okay. And where does your fascination with languages come from? Like, I've spoken to many people that are interested in learning a language, and I like learning languages as well. I have a slight interest for the history of languages, but you have a fascination. Like, you learn, you know so much about all of that. How did that come about?
Probably for various reasons. I mean, I've always been interested in languages, and I found I was good at them at school, and I had an idea that I'd like to work abroad sometime. I didn't know what to do, what I would do, or where I'd go, but I had this idea that I should learn languages and I can travel the world, and then actually I had this crazy idea that I could learn a new language every 6 months. And if I did that, then I could learn all the world's languages. At that time, I didn't know how many there were. You'd need many, many lifetimes to learn all the world's languages. There's so many of them. But I don't know. It's just something that I find interesting. I mean, the languages in themselves are interesting, but also traveling to different countries, meeting different people, learning about different cultures. I'm also interested in music, so I like listening to music from around the world. And when I find songs I like the sound of, I'll learn to sing them. That's how I got interested in Spanish and Portuguese and Irish and Scottish Gaelic and other languages. I listen to the songs, I like the sound of the songs. I started learning them, and then I learned the languages as well. So, and other languages I learned for practical reasons. I was going on a trip to somewhere like Italy or Turkey or whatever, so I learned a bit of the basic language, and then of course I got more interested in the language and culture and place and people and history. So everything, I'm interested in many things, not just language, but language is the kind of focus of that connects everything together.
All right, so that all makes sense for languages that are actually used, like Spanish. But you also learn languages that are not used anymore, and even languages that are artificial. And so there's this one language, Manx, that you learned.
Well, that is actually used. It kind of almost died out.
Okay.
But then it was revived, and now there are several hundred people who speak it fluently, and maybe 2,000 who use it to speak it to some degree. So if you go to the Isle of Man, which is a little island in the middle of the Irish Sea between England and Ireland, you can meet people who speak Manx. There are children who are growing up with Manx as their family language. Not many, but there's some. And there's a school where they teach everything through the medium of Manx. So it has some use. It is used, but there's no community you can go to, no village or town where everybody speaks it, or a significant number of people speak it. So you have to find people. You go to certain places, there's meetup groups, there's classes, there's music sessions, there's traditional dancing and choirs and things like that. So people do use the language. It's not kind of just, well, it is essentially enthusiasts who use it. But it's kind of building up momentum. More and more people are learning it. I mean, another language I've learned recently is Cornish, which has a similar situation, where it really did die out kind of at the end of the 19th century. And it was revived, but the trouble with Cornish is several different people revived it, and they kind of came up with different versions of it. Mm-hmm. And some people said, okay, well, the first person to try and revive it, he went around Cornwall, meeting people who knew a bit of the language, who could remember bits. They could maybe knew some numbers or some phrases or some songs or poems or whatever. And he wrote down everything he could find. And then he kind of reconstructed the language from those fragments that he mm-hmm. could find. And then other people said, well, you know, by that time, the language was very influenced by English. There wasn't much left. So let's go back to an earlier version of the language. There's some literature from the medieval period. So they based their revived language on that. Mm-hmm. And then other people kind of came up with different versions based on combinations of these. So there's no standard language there. There is a standard written language, but not spoken. Mm. So everybody's arguing about how to say things.
Okay.
So that's you know, not very helpful for people who just want to use the language.
Yeah, that's true. It worked But
according to the last census, 2011, about 400 or 500 people said they used Cornish as their first language.
Wow.
So there is a community of people who use that. Mm-hmm. But then if you look at the artificial languages, the invented languages like Esperanto, you know, there are, according to Wikipedia, about 2,000 native speakers of Esperanto, about 200,000 people who speak it fluently, and then another 2 million or so who know it to some extent. Mm-hmm. So it's quite a significant language in that respect. There are people who use it regularly. There are families who use it as their everyday language.
Wow.
And at the polyglot events I've been to, like in the polyglot gathering in Berlin, I'd say maybe half of the people who went there knew Esperanto to some degree, mm-hmm. and many were fluent. So, you know, it does have some real-world usage.
Yeah.
But then another invented language I've learned is Tokipona. Have you heard of that?
Only when I was reading up on your story.
Okay. It was invented by an American woman called Sonia Lang. It was a kind of thought experiment to see if you could create a language you can use to talk about anything, but it only has 120 words. Basically.
Okay.
So it's easy to learn. The grammar is pretty straightforward. There's no kind of conjugations or declensions or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's the word order that matters, so it's a bit like English or Mandarin. But to actually communicate meaningfully in it, it's quite difficult because you can't be very precise.
Yeah.
So few words. You know, you can kind of come up with combinations of words that you think mean one thing, and you say it to somebody, and they think you mean something else.
Yeah.
So it's not a very useful language, but it's just kind of fun.
Okay. And what motivated you to learn those artificial languages or those almost died out languages?
Well, Manx and Cornish I got interested in because I learned other Celtic languages, so I was interested to see how they compared and just wanted to know more about them. But then Esperanto I learned because, you know, I'd heard people say it's easy to learn, and, you know, I'd read about people who travel around the world using Esperanto.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of an early version of couch surfing. They had a system called Pasporto Servo, which had a list of Esperanto speakers around the world who were willing to kind of meet other Esperantists and maybe, you know, give them somewhere to stay, show them around their town. So, you know, people travel around like that, and I read about this, and I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. And I thought I'd give it a go. Tokipona, I met people who spoke it at the Polyglot events I've been to. And I met Sonia Lang, and she talked about it, and I thought, that sounds interesting. Maybe just for fun, just learn that. 120 words, can't be difficult.
That's true.
Actually, there's another 5 new words recently added to it, 125 words.
That I'm sure that makes a big difference.
Yeah. So, and then I've invented a few alphabets as well, just for fun. Like alternative ones for Mandarin, Welsh, English. And
did you get anybody to use them?
Not really, no. But I just invented them because I felt like it.
And that,
I'm just playing around.
Okay. That's very impressive to be so motivated with and so interested in languages to invent an own alphabet or several of them.
Yeah, and then last year I started inventing my own language as well.
How far?
I haven't got very far with it yet. I'm trying to make it kind of very onomatopoeic. For any word that has a kind of associated sound, I'm trying to make the word sound like whatever it is.
I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
I'm trying to make it so words kind of that you could, like wind would be something like, and water, how did I come up with water? That's kind of rain. So kind of sounds give you an idea of what the word means.
Okay, interesting.
And you can only do that for certain words. It's not for every word you can do that. But I was kind of trying to make it kind of sound interesting. Mm-hmm. Like to like is
Okay.
And the language itself is called blah blah.
All right. So I guess
so. It's a kind of jokey language. It's not serious, but I'm just kind of playing around with it.
So maybe Hollywood, when they have another alien movie or something, they can they can take your language.
Yeah, maybe. Well, I know people whose languages have been used in films, and TV series, like what's his name, David Peterson, who invented Dothraki in other languages used in Game of Thrones and. Of a series, and he did a talk at the Polyglot conference in New York 2 years ago about how he got into that and how he invents languages. So it is possible to make a career out of it. Mm-hmm. He's the only person I know who does that, but it is possible.
Yeah. Interesting. And so you learned quite a few languages and you reached fluency in a few of them, but in some you didn't.
Well, some I was fluent in the past. Like I used to speak German quite well.
Yeah, it's a pity that we can't do this in German.
Yeah, but it's a long time since I've used it, so I don't feel confident using it anymore.
Yeah.
And when I go to Germany, I'll speak German, but I know it's far from perfect.
That's okay.
And same with Japanese. You know, I did my degree in Chinese and Japanese, and while I was studying, I became reasonably competent in Japanese. I didn't spend enough time in Japan to become really fluent, like I did with Mandarin. I spent over 5 years in Taiwan, but I only spent 4 months in Japan, so it wasn't really enough to become fluent. And I think you need to spend time immersed in the language to really become fluent in it. I mean, you can study a lot on your own. You can study grammar and vocabulary. You can read, you can listen. But to really become fluent at speaking a language, you need to spend time immersed in it.
And your time in Taiwan, what was your language learning experience there like?
Well, for my degree, I did 1 year in England. Then I had a year abroad. So I didn't spend a semester in Taiwan, a semester in Japan. And then I spent 2 months in China traveling around. And then I spent 2 more years in England. And then I went back to Taiwan for another year of Chinese study. So my first time in Taiwan, I'd only spent a year learning Chinese. So I knew the basics. I could have basic conversations. I could read to some extent. My lessons in, I went to a university in Taiwan, had lessons every day, and they were all in Mandarin.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, it was really hard to understand everything.
Mm-hmm.
And the teacher spoke with a very standard Mandarin accent, but everybody else outside of the class had Taiwanese accents,
mm-hmm.
which sound quite different. It took a while to get used to those. And I was living with an elderly Taiwanese couple.
Mm-hmm.
And every afternoon after class, I would sit down with my landlady and she would talk at me, basically telling me all about her children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And I didn't follow most of what she said, but the experience of listening every day and trying to talk, really helped. And then I had friends outside class, language exchange partners, tandem partners, who I met regularly, and we talked, and they helped me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of through all that, by the end of 4 months, I was reasonably confident speaking Mandarin. I wouldn't say I was fluent,
mm-hmm.
but I could get by pretty well. And then a few more months in China later on helped as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I went back to Taiwan after I graduated, I got a scholarship to study for another year. And pretty much after that year, I was fluent.
Mm-hmm.
Then I got a job and I worked there for another 4 years. So that really cemented my Mandarin skills.
Mm-hmm.
And I used it to, I read and wrote quite a bit as well.
Mm-hmm.
Although I never really read kind of for pleasure. I read things I needed for work, and I translated things, and I wrote articles, but I never read novels.
Okay.
So I don't feel confident kind of reading, novels or short stories or even newspapers in Mandarin. I can do it if I have to.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not something I do for fun.
Mm-hmm.
I can do that in Welsh and French, and just about in Irish, and probably manage in German, maybe Spanish, but not in Mandarin, not in Chinese.
Yeah, I imagine that's hard.
Yeah, it's really, really hard. Mm-hmm. And it's easier these days, because if you're reading online, then you've got all sorts of dictionaries and things to help you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But back then, when I was studying, there was only paper dictionaries, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And to look up anything in the Chinese dictionary takes a long time.
I can imagine. Yeah, so you really threw yourself into the language, like speaking with your landlady without actually understanding her and like really living the language
before even
being able to actually grasp what it is all about.
Yeah. I'm kind of comfortable with not knowing everything.
Mm-hmm.
I like to understand things, but when I'm learning a new language, I do a lot of listening. So mm-hmm. at the moment, I'm doing a lot of listening to Russian language radio. So I'm trying to improve my Russian.
Mm-hmm.
And I maybe understand, 30% of it at the most.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes a bit more, depends what the subject is. But because I do that every day, gradually I'm absorbing more and I'm studying, I'm learning new words. And whenever a word that I've learned in a lesson comes up in the news, I think, oh, I know that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the more you hear words, the more they become familiar. And then if you come across them in a different context, you think, ah, yeah, I know that one.
Mm-hmm.
And that really helps.
Yeah, I guess that's very important for language learning, to be comfortable with not understanding everything and not being able to speak perfectly, because I guess that's the biggest challenge for language learners, that their expectations are too high.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a problem I have with Russian. I have Russian friends, and when I try and speak Russian to them, I'm always worried about making mistakes and mm-hmm. Getting the grammar right, and I'm thinking I don't know how to say anything.
Mm-hmm.
But if I just try and speak it, and then I find actually I can say more than I thought.
Mm.
I may not say it perfectly, but I could probably communicate.
Yeah, and that's the most important thing: make yourself understood.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the purpose of language.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, it depends who you're talking to. Some people, they'll correct every little mistake, and they'll, if you're talking to a friend, and you can say, okay, we're trying to let's just speak this language now, and you can help me, with the big mistakes, correct those, but don't correct everything. But if you're talking to just a random person in the street, if your knowledge of their language is very poor. And they speak English or whatever language you speak, then they're going to switch to that probably. Unless you say to them, would you mind, carrying on in your own language? Just try and simplify it. Try and help me here. But, not everybody has time or the patience to do that.
Because patience is very important.
Yeah, definitely. When you're learning a new language, you need people who are sympathetic and understand what you're going through. Patient and helpful and supportive. You don't need people who say, that's wrong, you're stupid.
of course. Or that switch to a more comfortable language,
Exactly.
just because they can't take it anymore.
I mean, what's your own experience with learning different languages?
So, like, with the patience thing, I know, I totally know how that is. I catch myself sometimes speaking to a person, like in a tandem, and then they speak super slowly German, and I grow really impatient, and I'm like, wait a second, I do exactly the same thing. Like, when I start speaking a language, I speak so slowly, and then I have to calm down and continue listening. And so it's a really big challenge
It is, yeah, definitely.
to have the patience to listen to the person, to help that person learn a language, to help that person learn that language. And I really appreciate it if people do that.
Yeah, definitely.
and that's
And
how you learn quickly.
I think if you go to a country where, like an English-speaking country particularly, where not many people learn foreign languages, then people are not going to switch to German or French or whatever, unless it's someone like me. But I wouldn't do that if it's someone asked me not to.
And you also see that with different countries. Like, if you come to Germany and you start speaking with somebody in German, but you're speaking slowly, then it's very likely they will switch to English. It's even more so in the Scandinavian countries or in Holland.
Absolutely.
If you go to the Latin American countries, then they'll stick to Spanish if you try speaking Spanish with them.
If they think you're if they speak English or another big language, then they might switch to that. But if they don't, then you have to speak their language.
But like, I've seen it both ways. I've seen it with even with like, I was in Colombia, and people were speaking English, but they were okay with me speaking Spanish to them, not that fluently. They were just so delighted that somebody would learn Spanish that they have much more patience than,
It's
for
interesting.
instance, a northern European would have.
What I've had when I meet kind of Japanese people, and I say to them, I speak Japanese. Sometimes I'll start speaking to them in Japanese, and they'll continue speaking in English. They're not believing I really speak Japanese. They think I just know a few words.
Yeah, that's true. I notice that sometimes too, some languages. Because I guess many people say they speak a language and then they're like, know five words and they say them. And I guess those Japanese speakers got fooled too many times, so
Maybe that's it.
now they don't believe it anymore. I know you also tried a lot of different language learning programs like Duolingo, Rosetta Stone, I don't know, Pimsleur, Teacherself, Colloquial, ASML. Which
I
ones
tried all those.
did you think were best suited, and which one for maybe different languages, or which ones did you think were thought through the best, in your opinion?
Well, I like the Teach Yourself and the colloquials. They're good to get you started. But I think for conversational language, there's some seem to work. Pimsleur's pretty good for that. and actually learning to speak and pronounce things well, but it doesn't cover a great deal and it's rather expensive. And Rosetta Stone is okay for learning vocabulary if you've got the patience, because it's not going to teach you how to speak a language fluently, but it can work quite well to learn basic vocabulary and some grammar if you can work out the structure from the examples. I mean, the trouble I had with Rosetta Stone, I used it for Russian, and I said, right, I'll try and learn Russian just from Rosetta Stone. I won't use any other programs, any other courses, and see how it goes. And I did that for 6 months, and after 6 months, I thought I couldn't have a conversation. And I thought after that time, I'd at least be able to say hello, how are you? Mm-hmm. My name is blah blah blah. Okay. But I couldn't say any of that. I could say the boy is riding a horse, the camel is standing on three legs, and the tiger is standing on the wall and stuff like that. So I knew basic vocabulary and some rather less useful vocabulary, unless you're a naturalist going on safari. So, and I realized after thinking about that, if you want to learn basic words, then put them in sentences with ridiculous words or unusual words. So if you want to learn a basic word like table, and then say, the dragon is dancing on the table or something, put it in a ridiculous context that's meaningful or stupid or vivid or whatever, makes interesting pictures in your head, and then you'll remember it. So, and that's a good way to learn kind of prepositions as well, on, under, behind, in, and all that sort of thing.
To learn them in a sentence that's very vivid, you said.
Yeah, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. So, think of an elephant sitting in an armchair. And then you remember the word for elephant and armchair and sitting and in, because it's such a ridiculous image.
That's very interesting. Like, I use mnemonics sometimes to learn words.
Yeah, I find those useful as well.
Yeah, but that's a new one. I haven't heard about that one, and it's an interesting technique. Gotta try it out.
Yeah, I haven't kind of implemented it very well yet, but I'm working on it.
Yeah, it's good. Do you have any other interesting techniques you picked up throughout the years for learning words, a language, whatever?
With the mnemonics, useful, definitely. Context is always useful.
So learning something within a context?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, one Welsh course I used had a series of stories set in a fictional village.
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of, each story got introduced to different characters and different situations. And because it's quite interesting and funny and sometimes silly, you kind of remember it, and I found that really good.
Yeah,
because most, a lot of language courses, like teach yourself, it's kind of, you arrive at the airport, you go to the hotel, you go to a meeting, you meet friends, blah blah blah.
Mm-hmm.
It's not very interesting. It's maybe things you actually do, but if you want to make it memorable, you've got to make it unusual or funny.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what kind of engages me and helps me remember things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, making language learning fun.
Yeah, and definitely learning reading books or translations of books that you enjoy, you know well.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people read various versions of Harry Potter in different languages, and if you have a translation and an audio book, you can listen to it and read. And reading aloud is good.
Mm-hmm.
So that you can practice, reading and listening and speaking at the same time.
Yeah, that's true.
I find that's a very useful exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've got the English or the your own native language version plus the translation, then you don't need to look up any words. You can just check if you've understood everything.
Mm. Yeah, I've heard recently about a new app that reads out like a short book, and it shows you what is red, and in this at the same time it shows you the translation. So you have like
Yeah, that sounds really good.
three
Yeah.
different channels.
Yeah.
Don't remember the name.
Is that a kind of text-to-speech system, or is it a real person reading it?
No, it's a real person reading it.
Yeah.
It's like it's for the purpose of language learning. I don't remember something with B. I don't remember the name,
Yeah.
but I thought it's very interesting because you have everything in one. Like you don't need to look up words. You
Yeah.
listen, you read.
Yeah,
Like,
that sounds really useful,
yeah.
definitely. And if it's an interesting story, something you find interesting,
Yeah.
then yeah, that would really help. I mean, not everybody likes to learn to read fiction, so if you're into nonfiction, whatever you like to read or listen to, then you can find content
Yeah, I like,
material that works for you.
yeah, definitely. Like, I think they had like 20 or 30 different sources at that time, but I guess that's very important to actually do stuff that you're interested in. And I think, in my opinion, that's the big problem of school, that everybody learns the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
No.
Yeah, I mean, some people, if you're into sports, then you could follow a sports team from the country whose language you're learning. Watch the matches and whatever they do, and that's a great way to learn. And people who are into sports seem to have amazing memory for statistics. Who scored goals and who plays for which team and all sorts of things like that. So if you're very good at remembering things like that, then you can kind of use that to help remember other things, maybe. So understanding how your memory works, the things you remember well, and then associate them with the things you need to learn, that might help you remember things.
Sure. Everybody's brain works differently, and everybody has to find their perfect strategy or method to
Yeah,
learn
exactly.
the language.
Or if you like songs, like singing, then you can find songs in the language that you like, and then learn the words, learn to sing them, and that's a fun way to do it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that was really interesting. That was great. Thanks so much.
Yeah.
Is there anything you would like to add?
Visit
OmniGlot.
OmniGlot.
I'll definitely link to it in the post.
Yeah, and if anybody who's visiting OmniGlot sees anything they think's wrong or could be improved, they can contact me. My email is feedback@omniglot.com,
All right.
and I'm particularly looking for recordings. If you can make recordings of any sample text, any phrases, or any of the other material on the site in your language, in your native language, ideally, then please send that to me. Best in MP3 format, but if other formats are fine. And if you want to make a video based on, say, useful phrases I've got, you make a little conversation in your language, that'd be very cool. Because I'm trying to find, as much material as possible to help people learn different languages.
Yeah, I think you're doing a very good job with that so far.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much.
Yeah, no problem.